From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. With about a month to go before his inauguration, Donald Trump is shaping up his cabinet, making choices that are worrying a lot of Democrats and even a few Republicans. Steve Bannon, who chaired the last few months of Donald Trump's divisive campaign, will be the chief strategist in the White House. Almost as soon as that was announced, people started protesting it.
No KKK, no fascist USA. No Bannon. No KKK, no fascist USA.
That was an anti-Bannon rally of about 500 people outside of LA's City Hall last month. The liberal organization Move On has collected more than a million signatures calling for Bannon to go, and smaller protests have popped up all over the country.
Steve Bannon, I feel, you know, is a man who appeals specifically to extremists. And so just his appointment sends this clear message about fear and hate as, you know, I guess being the accepted narrative for our country and our government.
That's Shay Roman with a Jewish activist group called If Not Now. Much of the criticism of Steve Bannon has focused on Breitbart News, the conservative website he ran before joining Trump's team. Bannon has called Breitbart the platform of the alt-right, which includes white nationalists. Shay says that Bannon and websites like Breitbart are giving hate a platform.
We have to think bigger than just the policies and the laws that might pass or might not, and just think about a larger social narrative that hating is okay and placing blame on other folks is okay. I mean, it's those kinds of ideas that lead to mass genocide.
Here are some Breitbart headlines published on Bannon's watch. Would you rather your child had feminism or cancer? Or this, young Muslims in the West are a ticking time bomb. Conservative commentator Bill Kristol was called a renegade Jew. Beyond the headlines on his website, Bannon himself has made some controversial statements. He told Donald Trump his stance on immigration isn't conservative enough. He called a former female employee a bimbo. And in 2011, he lashed out at feminists while promoting a film praising conservative female politicians like Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann.
In fact, the women that would leave this country would be pro-family. They would have husbands. They would love their children. You know, they wouldn't be a bunch of dykes that came from the Seven Sisters schools up in New England.
We'll hear more of Steve Bannon in his own words coming up, but first, some insight into how he operates. Here's Reveal's Emily Harris.
It's not just what Steve Bannon says that angers people who don't want him advising the president. It's also the beliefs he supports and allows to flourish on platforms he controls. Here's Bannon on his radio show last February with anti-Islam extremist Pamela Geller. They're talking about a speech President Obama had recently given on Islam.
The only religion attacking, subjugating, and slaughtering members of other religions en masse is Islam. The religion attacking other religions is Islam, and President Obama said nothing of this. Nothing of the gender apartheid, creed apartheid, cultural annihilation.
He's a smart, savvy, tough operator. What was he doing, Pamela Geller?
He was doing what he's been doing for the past 7 years. He's been in jihad denial. He was pandering to a Muslim...
Some Breitbart employees have defended Bannon as he's faced accusations of racism and misogyny. Here's Joel Pollack, a senior editor and the website's chief legal counsel on CNN.
Not at all. Steve Bannon does not have a bone of prejudice in his body.
Pollack tipped his head as he spoke, and he pointed to the yarmulke he wears as an Orthodox Jew. He noted that Bannon has hired women, Asian Americans, a Brit from a Muslim family to run Breitbart's London office.
And in fact, Steve Bannon went out of his way at Breitbart to look for talent among non-traditional conservatives.
But some ex-employees have been critical. Former Breitbart spokesman Kurt Bardella quit during the presidential primaries. He said the news site he supported had by then turned into a Trump propaganda machine. Bardella told CNN it doesn't matter if Bannon himself is sexist or racist.
Maybe he's not any of those things. Well, the audience that you're catering to certainly are those things. And so you're deliberately playing to that, playing to the worst divisiveness, the most prejudices, the worst racial divides, to either try to get traffic or motivate people to support you. And I think that's despicable.
Ryan Lenz edits the Hate Watch blog at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He can't forget one Breitbart headline.
Hoisting the Confederate flag loud and proud.
Hoisting the Confederate flag loud and proud. This was 2 weeks after a young white man had killed 9 African Americans in a church in South Carolina. Breitbart staff dismiss concerns about headlines like that, saying they're just provocative. But Lentz says it shows that Bannon exploits, creates, and tolerates fear and divisiveness in order to meet strategic goals. And that, he says, reveals who Bannon is.
I don't think that there is evidence to suggest definitively that Steve Bannon is a white supremacist or a closeted fan of the Third Reich. I think there is ample evidence to suggest, to prove, that under Steve Bannon's leadership, Breitbart News became the media arm of alt-right. It's white supremacy rebranded under a different name to make it politically palatable.
Bannon downplays charges of racism in right-wing movements, including in the Tea Party, which he was deeply involved with. At a conference of conservatives at the Vatican 2 years ago, Bannon said there are always fringe groups who join in, but they don't set the agenda. BuzzFeed recently dug up this recording of that speech.
I think when you look at any kind of revolution, you know, you always have kind of and this is a revolution, and you always have kind of people that are, you know, some groups that are disparate. I think that'll all burn away over time, and you'll see more of a mainstream center-right populist movement.
Some new presidents might consider such negative attention of a top advisor a liability. Not this one. After the election, Harvard hosted a forum with top staff from both the Trump and the Clinton campaigns. These postmortems are usually pretty friendly. But this time, things got heated when Clinton staff accused Bannon of divisive and racist tactics. Trump's campaign manager, now senior advisor, Kellyanne Conway, fired back.
The reason Steve Bannon was hired is the reason that he's going to be the chief strategist and special counsel to the president of the United States, is because he's a brilliant tactician.
So let's take a look at Steve Bannon's tactics. First, Breitbart. All caps, click me headlines, go to articles that sometimes don't substantiate the promised hype. The site mixes commentary with reporting. It focuses persistently on certain themes that match its anti-immigrant, anti-feminist, anti-political establishment agenda. Breitbart casts Black Lives Matter as inciting a race war aimed at destroying America. Whenever Planned Parenthood is mentioned, Breitbart calls the organization simply an abortion chain, sometimes even an abortion chain with Nazi roots, ignoring other services Planned Parenthood provides, like sex education and birth control, to avoid unwanted pregnancies in the first place. Bannon served on Breitbart's board since the private news company was started. He took over operations as executive chair in 2012, after founder Andrew Breitbart died unexpectedly. But that's not all Bannon did that year. He also started a nonprofit to pursue deeper research, working in tandem with the Daily News site. The mission statement of the Government Accountability Institute, known by its initials GAI, is to investigate and expose crony capitalism, misuse of taxpayer monies, and other government corruption and malfeasance. Sounds a lot like drain the swamp. Bloomberg Businessweek reporter Joshua Green visited GAI last year. It's in Tallahassee, Florida.
It looks something like what you get if Scarlett O'Hara were designing an office park. It's these little brick buildings, which are pretty plain, but there's big verandas with swooping fans, and the GAI staff will sit out on the veranda smoking cigars on afternoons and brainstorm about how to kind of go after Hillary or do their thing.
Breitbart and GAI share staff and have other financial ties. But unlike Breitbart, GAI doesn't traffic in quick hits. Researchers take months scraping the internet for credible dirt. Joshua Green calls this two-pronged approach Bannon's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
You know, on the one hand, you had Bannon doing this, you know, very serious, legitimate, stand-up, nonpartisan research through GAI, which I thought of as being his Dr. Jekyll side, you know, and then on the other hand, in his other life, he was the publisher, executive chairman of Breitbart News, which was this loud, obnoxious, crusading, sometimes offensive right-wing news site that I think of as being more like a Mr. Hyde.
The combination means Bannon can deliver the same message but packaged differently for two very different audiences, fans of the right-wing talk show circuit and subscribers of mainstream media. Let's break down one example of how this works. Last year, presidential hopefuls were still testing their chances, and HarperCollins published a book called Clinton Cash. The story laid out connections between foreign businesses and donations to the Clinton Foundation. It was written by GAI's president, Peter Schweitzer, based on information GAI researchers had dug up. It alleged that Clinton abused her position as Secretary of State. An early copy wound up in the hands of several mainstream media outlets, including the Washington Post.
We had been pursuing a lot of storylines involving the Clintons.
The Post's deputy national politics editor, Peter Walston, knew Schweitzer from his previous publications. Schweitzer doesn't only go after Democrats. He wrote a book in 2011 revealing insider stock trading by many members of Congress. That got a law changed. In 2013, Schweitzer accused Republican leader John Boehner of essentially charging companies to get hearings on certain bills. Schweitzer's reputation is part of why the Washington Post paid attention.
If Peter Schweitzer called me up tomorrow and said that he had an amazing story tip for me, I would listen to what he had to say, and then I would decide whether it's worth pursuing, and then we would, if we pursued it, we would report it to the ground and figure out whether it was a story.
In 2015, articles investigating the Clinton Foundation and foreign donations spread throughout the mainstream media. Some cited leads from Schweitzer's research. Then Breitbart came back in the picture. The site posted a list of 11 explosive facts in the Clinton book that it said were verified by the mainstream media. Bloomberg's Joshua Green says this is a perfect example of what Bannon's backers call his brilliance.
He could go over to Breitbart and they could run these rolling narratives saying, look, it's not just us saying that Hillary is nefarious and evil and corrupt. Here's the New York Times saying it over here, and here's a story from the Washington Post, and here's 60 Minutes. And he could both excite the right-wing populist base while at the same time disillusioning Hillary Clinton's core of support.
Whether Steve Bannon is going after Hillary Clinton or Republicans in Congress, his big beef is what he calls crony capitalism, people who profit from their political power. In that Vatican speech 2 years ago, Bannon bragged about Breitbart helping get Republican Majority Leader Eric Cantor knocked out of office by a Tea Party candidate.
The reason that this guy won is quite simple, is that middle-class people and working-class people are tired of people who say they're conservative selling out their interest every day to crony capitalists.
If you peel back the layers, this fury at politicians getting rich is at the core of Bannon's motivation. It may also be his Achilles heel. Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley says Bannon's boss, Donald Trump, campaigned against money influencing Washington. But key cabinet positions so far signal the opposite.
I think many folks thought he really would take on the corporate culture that kind of symbolized by drain the swamp. However, he's not draining the swamp unless he's draining it directly into his cabinet.
Merkley's a Trump opponent, but even some of Trump's core supporters have started to air similar concerns about crony capitalism within the White House. As Trump's chief White House strategist, the question is, how might Steve Bannon respond?
That story was produced by Reveal's Emily Harris. So what does Steve Bannon really believe in? And where do those beliefs come from? Reveal's Amy Julia Harris has been listening through his speeches and talking to people who know him. So Amy, what'd you find out?
Well, the things that make headlines for Steve Bannon are him making disparaging comments about women, and he's told some of his friends that he thinks that some people are genetically superior to others, that only property owners should be able to vote. He's been kind of extreme in a few of these offhand comments that he's made, but the recurring theme throughout his speeches is something that Emily touched on in her story, what he sees as crony capitalism. And that really, really angers him. Breitbart News was built on the rise of the Tea Party, and their whole platform was based on anger on the elites and the existing system that they felt like wasn't working for them. And Steve Bannon got in the trenches with the Tea Party. He was traveling around the country with them, and here he is at a rally in New York City in 2010, really laying out what's on his mind.
In the last 20 years, our financial elites and the political class have taken care of themselves and led our country to the brink of ruin.
Amen!
Do you think crony capitalism is Bannon's number one issue, or is there anything else that's kind of vying for that spot?
So Steve Bannon's really worried about the unmooring of American society, saying that we're losing our Judeo-Christian center. Our values are sort of under attack. And he sees that as going hand in hand with the rise of Islam and the secularization of the West.
Now, that all converges with something that we have to face, and it's a very unpleasant topic. But we are in an outright war against jihadist Islam, Islamic fascism. This war is I think, metastasizing far quicker than governments can handle it.
So here he is speaking to the Vatican in 2014, laying out the threat he sees of radical Islam. He likes these big fights. I talked to one of his friends who said that he sees life as an epic battle between good and evil. That's how he views everything.
So, Amy, where do you think these views came from?
I think there are a few different moments in Steve Bannon's life that really crystallize his political thinking. One of them was his time in the Navy in the late 70s, early 80s. He was serving under President Jimmy Carter. He was on a destroyer and was sailing around the Persian Gulf. And I talked to some of his Navy friends who said that time really made Steve Bannon even more conservative because he saw Jimmy Carter as weak. He didn't like being pushed around by the Soviets and was just kind of embarrassed by America's foreign policy. So Reagan's presidency really resonated with him. Steve Bannon, after he left Goldman Sachs, was making this documentary about Reagan, and it was initially going to be a standard biopic. But then September 11th happened, and that really changed his thinking. Here is his co-producer, Tim Watkins, laying out how Steve Bannon's thinking shifted.
9/11 happened, and it kind of changed our perspective on the whole idea of the film. We found kind of this thread throughout Ronald Reagan's youth and into his public life and how he had a strong disdain for communism. So that kind of changed the whole direction of the film that we were making into what it ultimately became today. And the thesis that we kind of came out of that was life is a battle of good versus evil and history repeats itself.
So this guy is going to be in the White House. He's going to have the president's ear. What should we expect? What kind of advice is he going to be giving Donald Trump?
You know, I think we sort of have to go on what he has said. He's come out strongly against illegal immigration and some immigration. And he said that he's very pro-typical conservative values, family values. He's pro-life. People have said that those are sort of the guiding principles of Steve Bannon, and those are going to be the things that he tells Donald Trump.
Thank you very much. That's Reveal's Amy Julia Harris. And for the record, we requested an interview with Steve Bannon, but his office didn't get back to us. Our team here at Reveal will continue to investigate the incoming Trump administration and will bring you these stories over the coming weeks and months. Coming up, with the holidays just around the corner, a lot of us will be packing our bags and our gifts and heading to an airport to visit family and friends. And for some of us, things won't go according to plan. Like with these folks who tried to save money by flying a budget airline.
Chaos. It was just pure chaos because no one had any clue what was going on, where to go, what to do. There's no signage. And we were like, well, do we just get our bags and sleep in the airport or, you know, what's going on?
A no-frills travel nightmare next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, listeners. Julia B. Chan here, Reveal's digital editor. A lot has happened this year, and we've produced a lot of investigative reporting because of it. 52 shows. And you've listened to it all, right? So tell us, what was your favorite story or moment from Reveal this year? We want to hear from you, because you've stuck by us as we've uncovered injustices, confronted wrongdoers, and spoke up for the vulnerable. Which story really affected or outraged you? Was there a scene that you just can't shake? A moment that stuck with you? Go to revealnews.org/fave, that's F-A-V, to tell us about the time Reveal made you stop and listen. We may use some of your responses on the show or online. So again, that's revealnews.org. bannon.org/FAV.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. It's Christmas time, and I cannot tell you how happy I am to be talking to you now. Not because I love the holidays. No, I'm a little grinchy. No, me talking to you right now means that this year I am not working on an airplane. You see, many years ago, before I got into my current line of work, I was a flight attendant. I did it for almost 10 years, working for a regional airline that, for the most part, was a great job. Except during the holidays, it gets rough. Planes are oversold, people tend to pack their brains with their luggage, and, well, folks can be challenging. But even when it's not the holidays, travel can be stressful. Everyone has a nightmare story. And this next one comes to us from our executive producer, Kevin Sullivan, or actually his sister, Erin.
So our flight was supposed to take off around 8 o'clock from Baltimore on Thursday, and we didn't arrive to Paris until about 5 o'clock on Saturday.
Erin and her husband had booked a flight with a discount airline out of Iceland called WOW Air. They were flying to Paris for Euro 2016. Apparently, this is a big deal in the world of soccer. Sorry, I know nothing of this. Anyway, when they get to the airport, they go to the gate and find out their flight's delayed. So they're going to miss their connection in Reykjavik.
We were running a little bit late, and then we were kind of happy, actually, that the flight was delayed a little bit. And then they told us right away that there was no way we would be making it to our destination the next day. And we were actually really excited about it because we had never been to Reykjavik, and so it seemed like a good idea.
So a night in Iceland is no big deal for them, and it's supposed to be beautiful, right? But other passengers aren't so happy, like Doug McCullum from Chicago, who's also a big soccer fan.
I was traveling with a business school friend. We just graduated in May, and we're going to see the Euro 2016 tournament in France.
Doug and his friends had been bumped the day before, so this flight was his second try to get to Paris. Another guy who wasn't too happy.
Andrew Tanker. I live in Austin, Texas, and I'm in public relations.
Andrew asked the WOW gate agent what they can do about the delay, and the woman says he can bail out of the trip and get a full refund. But seriously?
We're not going to plan an international trip for months and then just cancel it at the airport. We figured, how long could it possibly be before we get to Paris? It's a popular destination. We'll be there in no time.
So they all get on the plane and fly to Reykjavik, hoping for the best. But Andrew says when they get there...
chaos. It was just pure chaos because no one had any clue what was going on, where to go, what to do. There was no signage. And we were like, well, do we just get our bags and sleep in the airport or, what's going on?
They finally find a guy who's supposed to help them get to their hotels.
So people were like lunging at him, throwing their passports, screaming their names at him. And we're asking him, where are these hotels? Like, what are we doing? When's the next flight? And he said, I don't work for WOW. I have no information. I'm just here to put you on the shuttle bus.
So the next morning, we were told to be ready at 4 a.m. at the hotel where I was. But while we were on the bus going to the airport, people started to notice that they were being rebooked, but to Amsterdam.
You heard that right, Amsterdam. Now, let's recap. They leave Baltimore on Thursday, spend the night in Reykjavik, then Friday morning they find out they have to fly to Amsterdam, figuring they'll be put on another flight to Paris. But when they get to Amsterdam, things get worse.
This is when Andrew loses his luggage, correct, Andrew?
Yes.
And this is, no offense, but this is when I was willing to totally ditch you, Andrew. I don't know if you remember that, but I was like...
all good.
There's a woman at the airport to help them, but it turns out she doesn't work for WOW. She works for another company that WOW hired. Now, this is a common way low-cost carriers save money.
And she was the one that was in charge of escorting us to what we found out would be the train station.
Yep, the train station. Turns out, WOW has not booked them on a flight to Paris. Instead, they have to take a train. So now they're essentially stranded in Amsterdam. If they want to get to the Euro 2016 in Paris, they have to pay their own way.
So sorry.
For a three-hour delay to turn into $48.
And this poor girl, she was very empathetic and apologetic.
Erin actually recorded what happened there on her phone.
as soon as I know anything, I will let you know.
And she's like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, this is all I know. They told me to take you here, drop you off, and that was it. And she was so stressed out that she did start to cry quite a bit.
In the end, they take the train to Paris. They also filed claims with WOW. It took a long time and a lot of Twitter shaming of WOW, but Doug and Andrew eventually got reimbursed for most of their expenses. Aaron did not badger WOW, and 6 months later has not received a dime.
And so after all of this, I mean, you guys have gone on an odyssey. What is it that you take away from it? Like, what have you learned?
Don't fly WOW.
You know, WOW's tagline is they leave you with a WOW feeling and they accomplish their mission. I mean, that is 100% true. We left with a WOW feeling.
In a statement, WOW admitted to us that everything that could go wrong went wrong back in June and that the situation could have been handled better. And while a lot of you listening might say, okay, I got it, I'm just not going to fly WOW or other ultra low-cost carriers like Spirit or Allegiant, the truth is, these budget airlines are affecting the entire industry because they are making so much money.
And if you go and look at the earnings report for an airline like Spirit, you're going to see how much money they are making in ancillary fees. They are wildly profitable. The shareholders love them, and they're profiting by deception.
Is it deception or good business? We get the backstory on Discount Air Travel and meet one of the people responsible for all those extra fees airlines are now charging. Yeah, thanks for that. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hi there, this is reporter Will Evans. I recently investigated problems inside another controversial transportation company, Uber. Former security professionals there told me that Uber allowed thousands of employees to access sensitive customer information. Some employees even helped people stalk their exes or search for trip information on celebrities like Beyonce. According to one whistleblower, if you catch a ride with Uber, your personal information is not safe. To find out more, check out my story at revealnews.org/Uber. That's UBER.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Air travel meltdowns, like the one we just heard about on WOW Air, don't happen every day, but they are more likely to happen when you're flying low-budget, no-frills airlines. And the delays aren't the only thing people complain about.
Air travel can suck. We get it. You would believe all the hate Spirit's heard.
Spirit wants to be better at explaining how they're different from other airlines. They're just trying to keep airfares low.
Spirit's all about less money, more go. Some people hate Spirit, let's help them get it. It's a cheap seat for a cheap ass.
This video was produced by Spirit Airlines, a small, low-budget airline based in Florida. They know they are the poster child for cheap air travel in America. And they also know that people really hate them. No matter where you look for customer feedback, Spirit is at the bottom of the heap. Customers complain about Spirit at a higher rate than any other airline, 6 times higher than other U.S. airlines in 2015, according to the Department of Transportation. So what are they so upset about? Well, the seats are really cramped. More than 1 in 4 flights arrive late. That's one of the worst records in the U.S. But one of the most vocal complaints is about being nickel and dimed to death.
I just got charged from a carry-on. Maybe pay for water, no leg room. And this guy says he'd rather eat broken glass than fly with Spirit.
Here's the thing, though. As hated as it is, Spirit also makes a ton of money with profit margins that are sky high. That's why even major carriers are following Spirit's lead, lowering fares and charging extra for stuff that used to be included. So we wanted to know how this all started and what we can do about it, if anything. We asked reporter Karen Pellin to look into it.
I'd never flown on Spirit Airlines, and since I had to travel for this story, I wanted to give it a try. Using Spirit's website, my flight from Portland, Oregon to Los Angeles was listed at $118. But then, clicking through the site, I was first offered hotels or rental cars. No thanks. How about luggage? One carry-on, please. $35. Do I want to pick my seat? Sure, why not? I chose the, quote, big front seat, which is basically a large, comfy seat like you'd find in first class on any other airline. $25. Do I want to be able to change my itinerary? No, not for $45, I don't. Check in online for free or at the airport for $10? That's a no-brainer. Travel insurance for $14? Nope. And lastly, do I want to join Spirit's $9 fare club? No. My total? $178. At that point, it wasn't my cheapest option, but I wanted the Spirit experience.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you traveling on Spirit Flight 991 with service Los Angeles.
A couple weeks later, I'm waiting at my gate to board, and I chat with fellow passenger Matt, who's been experimenting with Spirit. On his last trip, although Spirit was cheaper than the competition when he first booked the ticket, Matt learned a painful lesson about carry-on bags. They charge more for them at the airport than if you pay ahead of time online.
I didn't realize that I would have to pay an extra, $50 to $60. So when I ended up getting dinged for the carry-on, ended up being considerably more expensive than the alternative would have been.
If Matt had tried to sneak on the plane with his carry-on bag without paying at the counter, it would have cost him $100.
That $100 bag fee at the gate should probably be $1,000. It's not a fee, wow. It's a fine. We don't want it to happen.
That's Ben Baldanza, the man who's probably more responsible than anyone for making Spirit the bare-bones airline we know and hate today. He was speaking to students at the University of Chicago in 2015. Ben was CEO of the company from 2006 until last January, but he still got his hands in the industry, serving on the boards of a couple no-frills airlines, including WOW. Remember them? But I found him at the head of a smallish classroom at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
All right. Last week, you all got a copy of the case 3, which is the distribution case, and there's probably some things in there that didn't make perfect sense to you. So I want to talk about that for just a few minutes.
In his mid-50s, Professor Baldanza is built like a wrestler, stout and full of energy. He scrawls on a whiteboard in front of about 20 students, teaching a new elective called Airline Economics. And tonight's topic? Frequent flyer programs.
In 2002, I was the head of marketing for U.S. Airways.
Ben tells the story of how U.S. Airways revamped its frequent flyer program. It was just the first of many things over the years that would shape Ben's reputation of being a real, well, jerk.
You can imagine this didn't go over very well. And in fact, what happened is a whole group of customers that were affected by this, created sort of an advocacy group, and they called themselves the cockroaches because they said that the airline was treating them like cockroaches. And they created an award for me and named me the 2003 Asshole of the Year and gave me a plaque, and I have that plaque.
Ben's harsh reputation at U.S. Airways followed him to Spirit, where he put in place even more rules we hate, like strict no-refund policies or charging for water. Yes, water. It all made Ben the Scrooge of the friendly skies. But back in the classroom, the students love him, and they're drinking his Kool-Aid. Here's 19-year-old sophomore Grant Pateras.
I definitely feel like Spirit being a low-cost carrier is definitely like the way forward for the industry, because I think consumers really like not having to deal with any of the BS extra things that's included when they can just pick and choose what they want and pay extra for it.
But paying for those BS extra things is what most people hate. Those charges are called ancillary fees, and Ben has a much different take.
The beautiful thing about ancillary fees, though, is it puts the pricing power in the consumer's hands. You can't, as a customer, decide what fuel to put in the tanks, what wage am I going to pay the pilots. But you can decide how many bags you take, whether you eat in the airport or bring your own food or buy the airline's food. You can make those decisions, and putting that pricing power in consumers' hands is a very empowering thing, right?
Wrong. According to this guy,
in the airline industry, this is not a free market. This is an oligopoly.
That's consumer advocate Chris Elliott, who says all that decision-making power Ben talks about, all the choices the industry claims we now have, it's misleading.
It's four airlines controlling 80% of all air travel domestically.
He's talking about American, United, Delta, and Southwest. All that consolidation, he says, has given the airlines too much power, and they hold consumers over a barrel. Even the big airlines have draconian policies like charging $200 to change a ticket. And then there's all those other fees.
You have discount airlines that are charging you to carry a bag on the plane. Does anyone out there think that that's not absurd?
Well, last night I had dinner with Ben Baldanza.
How is Ben doing?
He's doing great. He's teaching a class at George Mason University. His students are very enthusiastic about airline economics.
Oh my gosh. He's going to unleash a whole classroom of them on the world.
I found Chris to be rather zen, but on the inside, he's raging. He says he does daily breathing exercises to cope with all the negative mojo in his work. For almost 20 years, he's been fighting the airlines on behalf of disgruntled passengers.
There are people like your parents, like my parents, who don't fly very often. They see a low fare. They assume that it's going to be just like flying on a legacy carrier or on Southwest, or like flying was before deregulation, where everything is included. They show up. Your boarding pass costs money to print out. You have to pay for meals. Really, anything that's not nailed down, there's a fee for. And if you go and look at the earnings report for an airline like Spirit, you're going to see how much money they are making in ancillary fees. They are wildly profitable. The shareholders love them, and they're profiting by deception.
Profiting by deception is a serious accusation, and those who feel deceived keep Chris Elliott very busy. So I wanted to know, are we getting snookered by the airlines?
It does seem to be an industry where people sometimes feel deceived.
Industry analyst Seth Kaplan blames a lot of that feeling on how airlines like Spirit rolled out their fee programs. They were desperate to raise revenues and stay afloat and didn't really think it through. In Spirit's case,
for a while, if you weren't paying very close attention, if you were booking on their site, you might have thought that you had to pick a seat and pay for that seat assignment, or else, you know, who knows, maybe there won't be a seat for you. And that wasn't true. I mean, they always would have assigned you a seat when you checked in at no cost, but it wasn't necessarily clear. You know, people did feel deceived.
So how did we get here? To a time when airlines are charging for all this stuff? To answer that, we have to go back to a time when they didn't. It was all included in the price of your ticket. Here's a 1970s commercial featuring sportscaster Vin Scully, the voice of the Dodgers.
Of course, on Continental, you don't have to stay in your seat all the time to have a good time. You can get up and go into the only coach pub in the sky. In the pub, you can relax with friends, enjoy free popcorn, or play exciting electronic pub pong games.
The airports weren't that crowded. The seats in the airplanes were usually quite nice and quite large and a lot of space.
Ben Baldanza remembers those days. I meet up with him at his modern palatial home in Arlington, Virginia. His two feisty dachshunds curl up beside him on the couch.
Larger airplanes may have had a piano bar in the planes.
Really?
On Pan Am and things like that, that's right. Almost like you might think of like a nice cruise ship. People would dress up for flights. You wouldn't see people in shorts and T-shirts.
You got a meal, and you could check as many bags as you wanted.
As many bags you want. You got fed even on relatively short flights. It was generally a very country club-ish kind of experience.
But for all that luxury, there were definitely drawbacks.
The good old days were not so good.
Again, industry analyst Seth Kaplan.
Anybody, first of all, who talks about how great things used to be in the 1970s on airplanes is actually revealing that they're one of an elite group of people who could afford to fly at all in the 1970s, because most Americans couldn't fly then.
It's been said that only 15% of Americans had ever been on a plane in those days. And yeah, it was pricey. For example, in 1977, a round-trip flight on TWA between New York and San Francisco cost $420. In today's money, that's just over $1,700, about 2 to 3 times what you can expect to pay these days. But back in the 70s, even if the airlines wanted to lower fares, they couldn't, because the whole industry was regulated by the government.
Airlines had no commercial freedom to decide where they would fly or how much they would charge. So something as simple as, you know, I want to fly from New York to Orlando, they had to go to the government and get permission for that. You know, the government told them how much they could charge. And it actually guaranteed a lot of them a certain level of profitability, but it also limited their ability to grow quite clearly. And it very much limited the number of people who could fly.
In 1978, all that changed when the government passed the Airline Deregulation Act. Suddenly, airlines had to make their own decisions about pricing and routes. But they also had to deal with unexpected things like oil embargoes and recessions without help from the government. And then, the biggest blow of all, 9/11. A lot of people just stopped flying. A lot of airlines went bankrupt, liquidated, and merged. Spirit Airlines was teetering on the brink of collapse. But then, in 2006, Ben Baldanza came into the picture as the new CEO. Everybody in the business knew that lowering fares would sell more tickets, but Ben and Spirit figured out the magic formula.
We're not going to compete for customers based on having a nicer product or having a more flexible schedule. We're just going to have the lowest fare, damn it. And so the company started thinking about how can it lower its cost of production, flying the planes more hours per day, say, what's wrong with midnight to 6 a.m.? Looking through every part of the operation to lower costs. At the other side, we said, well, why make people pay for things that they're not using? And at the time, we noted that something like only 70% of our passengers even checked a bag. So he said, well, the 30% that aren't checking a bag, why are they paying for all the bag infrastructure? We could charge them a lower rate. And Spirit went through a process over a number of years of adding ancillary charges and correspondingly lowering the fare.
Sounds reasonable when you put it that way. Spirit has offered some screaming deals over the years. If you're lucky, you can find one-way fares for just under $50, sometimes even $20. And that new model paid off big time. In just a few years, Spirit went from being an airline that could barely keep the lights on to one of the most profitable in the world. Now, that's not to say they made more total money than the big airlines. They just had higher margins. And those fees are a big part of that. They make up more than 40% of Spirit's total revenue. But as we've said, they also confound people. In the spring of 2010, the Today Show's Matt Lauer asked Ben to please explain Spirit's announcement that it would soon become the first to charge for carry-on bags, something that even today, passengers find unbelievable.
Mr. Baldanza, I Googled you last night. You know, you are a good businessman. You know the aviation industry. You're a smart guy. You had to know this was going to go over like a fart in church, pardon the expression, when you announced this. Why do you think this is a good idea?
Well, certainly when you look at just the fee, Matt, on its own, it can cause some outrage.
It may be outrageous, but it also worked. And Spirit's three-pronged strategy, cutting costs everywhere outside of safety, lowering fares, and charging for all the frills, was contagious. So ultra-low-cost carriers take the first unpopular step. Then, as Matt Lauer noted, the legacy airlines follow suit.
Snacks used to be free, but on United, passengers now pay anywhere from $3 to $9 for a mid-flight treat. Your first check bag on AirTran will set you back $15.
But what about passengers feeling deceived, not knowing about all those extra fees when booking their tickets? It can be especially confusing when booking on third-party websites like Expedia. Well, over the past few years, Spirit has vastly improved its own website and has, along with other airlines, negotiated terms with those third-party companies to help crystallize their booking policies. Analyst Seth Kaplan.
Now it is more clear. They definitely tell you it's not in real fine print, but it's still not quite as clear as if you booked directly on the airline site.
So here's the best advice I can give you. Book directly with the airline. When I did that for my Spirit flight, it was very clear what I was paying for and what I wasn't. But something you won't see on an airline's website is the fact that ultra-low-cost airlines are tiny. They don't have a lot of planes, they don't partner with other airlines, and they don't fly very often. That means a single delay or cancellation can leave passengers stranded. That's what happened to our friends who flew WOW in Iceland this summer. Something else about ultra-low-cost carriers? A lot of the people you think are their employees really aren't. They work for another company, hired by the airline. This saves money, but it also means that when things go wrong at the airport, there's nobody from the airline to help passengers. Another problem with WOW this summer. In the years since deregulation, we went from having comfortable, entertaining flights with onboard pubs and video games that almost nobody could afford, to mostly uncomfortable, annoying, and cramped flights that almost anybody can afford. It's been a painful, confusing, and mysterious ride for both airlines and passengers, but here we are. Seth Kaplan says the industry is as stable as it's ever been. But will it last?
And that's the question, is have they created a more sustainable industry where the boom and bust cycle isn't going to be as extreme as it was in the past? They think they have.
We'll have to wait for the next big crisis to know if that's true. But there's no doubt that Spirit Airlines and Ben Baldanza made their mark on the industry. And Ben has no regrets.
You know, I'm immensely proud of what Spirit built. And Spirit moved the industry in some ways that not everybody's happy about, but has been better for the industry. The industry is more stable because of that. And I'm very, very proud of that. All that said, there were very rough times at Spirit. And we had a good understanding at Spirit that the airline we were building wasn't necessarily the airline we ourselves would always want to fly, but it was serving a specific demographic in a better way than any other airline was addressing. And we liked that fact. We liked the fact that we were changing the world within our own little space.
That story was produced by Karen Pelland. Flying is definitely not what it used to be in the old days. Who knew it'd be so bare bones after being so luxurious in the 60s and 70s. The airlines had no idea. The government definitely didn't know what would happen when it deregulated the industry. But as it turns out, there was just one person, just one, who predicted no-frills air travel was heading our way years, even decades before it became a thing.
Hello, is this Al?
This is he.
Hi, dear. It's Carol Burnett calling.
My goodness, she just made my entire life by saying...
Yep, that's Carol Burnett. I got to talk to Carol Burnett. I grew up watching her TV show. Every time it came on, my family sat around the TV and we all watched it, just like millions of Americans. It was truly an honor to talk to her. So back in 1974, when Pan Am and TWA ruled the skies, people actually dressed up to travel by plane. And so Carol's team thought a lot about that and thought it would be absolutely absurd for people to fly no frills. So they dreamed up a skit about it.
I'm the flight attendant. So Harvey is in first class. And Tim comes in, and he's right, going to sit right behind Harvey.
Well, I guess I'm in the seat right behind you there. I'm in the no frills section. Yeah. Oh, is that right? Save a lot of money going that way, you know. And
really?
It's like they say, you know, the back of the plane gets there the same time as the front.
That, of course, is Tim Conway, and the first class passenger is played by Harvey Korman.
Yeah, you know you save $40 by going this way?
Yeah.
Of course, you don't get any food or anything. That's why I brought this along. Yeah, you show me an airplane meal is worth $40. No way. But everything else is the same, so you just...
But just like passengers today find out when they go cheap, it's not the same at all. First, Conway discovers his overhead bin is crammed with spare parts for the plane, which come crashing down on his head when he pops it open. Then he notices that his section of the plane has no carpet.
Excuse me, are you in the no-frills section?
Yes.
Well, then get your foot off our rug.
You kick his foot.
Yeah.
Stewardesses, please prepare for takeoff.
So Carol checks to make sure the passengers in first class have their seatbelts on, but totally ignores the no-frills people.
Thank you so much.
Oh, miss.
What?
My seatbelt isn't fastened.
So?
Well, it isn't fastened because I don't have one.
So I toss him a rope. I put a rope around it.
It's funny to me that today, like so many years later, we are looking back on a skit that you did that is still relevant today. And I'm curious, like, how do you do that in comedy? How do you make something that, like, can stand the years?
Well, you know something? What we did not do was be to make everything relevant with what was happening at the time. So we just went for laughs. And I dare anybody to look at No Frills and not laugh. And that's over 40 years old, and I get fan mail now from 10-year-olds.
Wow.
And I also get letters saying, why can't a lot of the shows be that funny today?
That was the great Carol Burnett, who confesses that the skit was her only experience flying No Frills air travel. And for those of you who are all too familiar with economy flying, check out the skit on the web or on DVD. I have just one last request for you, and then I will let you go. But would you mind doing the Tarzan yell?
Oh, my God. All right, here we go. I probably scared the hell out of my kitten.
Listen, that was amazing. Thank you. We hope your holiday travels are better than the ones that we've described in this show. And please, 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 be nice to your flight attendant. Our show was edited by Taki Telenidis. Karen Pellin, Emily Harris, and Amy Julia Harris produced today's show. And on things you should be listening to, you got to check out The Outside Podcast. I love this podcast because it's the exact opposite of me. I have no survival instincts whatsoever. You take me out of the city, done, dead. If there's a zombie apocalypse, my job is to be food. But The Outside Podcast is all about that. Remarkable tales of survival, including a recent episode on a diver who spent 2 days trapped underwater in a shipwreck. I haven't listened to that episode, but I'm going to as soon as I'm done because I mean, how do you do that? What do you do? I don't know. That's why you listen to The Outside Podcast. Check it out on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins. My man, Mr. Jay Breezy, Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. They had additional help from Peter Kahnheim. Our head of studio is Kristen Scharfenberg. Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerato, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.